beyond the lectures. Express appreciation to the eldership overseeing the school of preaching, which is so badly needed in the brotherhood and badly needed, I think, in the valley. My assignment is whether Mark 16:9-20 is fraudulent or genuine. And with that assignment, I feel a little bit like Adam and Eve in their ideal marriage. Adam never had to hear about all the fellas that she dated. And she never had to hear how mother coddled him and cooked for him, cleaned the house. I didn't have to study the baptism of Jesus, the work of John the Baptist, or the Great Commission, or the Q document, or marriage, divorce, or anything else out of the Gospel of Mark. There are very few translations on the market which do not reject or seriously cast doubt on the authenticity of Mark 16:9-20. And associated with the genuineness of these passages is likewise the authorship of the Gospel of Mark. This section of New Testament Scripture has caused more puzzlement and consternation among Bible students than almost any variant reading in the Greek New Testament. The question of being either genuine or fraudulent is much too broad for me to adequately cover in the few minutes that we're allotted today. And for this reason, I appreciate the leniency of the director in allowing me more pages in the book than normally was allowed to other writers. Now, by fraudulent, I mean containing fraud, found on fraud, or proceeding from fraud. Is that what Mark 16:9-20 is? Or is it genuine? And by that, we mean the quality of being genuine, that is, of the original stock, actually coming from the alleged source, in this case, from the pen of Mark, and thus from the Gospel of Mark. We mean authentic and not counterfeit. And our study will just briefly discuss the problem outlined and the problem resolved and then the conclusion. But the subject is a complex study, and the subject is a technical study. Several years ago, Brother Thomas B. Warren and I sat eating a meal together. And we were talking about the Ballard-Warren debate. And as you know, Brother Warren published a small pamphlet called, or titled, Is Mark 16:9-20 Inspired? And he told me a story that I want to relate to you. In 1950, a Brother Borden debated Dr. Ballard, the Baptist preacher. Brother Warren was in the audience. Brother Borden used Mark 16:15-16 in dealing with a doctrine of salvation. And Dr. Ballard came back and said the text is spurious. And in a break in the debate, Brother Warden said that Brother Borden came back and sat down beside him. And he said, Brother Warren, I don't know how to answer the fact that Mark 16:15-16 is not genuine. Do you know how? And Brother Warren said, yes, I know how to answer it. He said, give me the answer. And Brother Warren said, no. He said, the answer is so complex. If I give you a brief answer, you'll just dig your hole deeper. About 2 years later, Brother Warren debated Dr. Ballard and set forth Mark 16, 15, 16 as teaching scripture pertinent to salvation. And true to form, Dr. Ballard arose and denied the genuineness of the text. And Brother Warren was ready. I want to suggest something to us that we need to study, and not by blind faith deal with things. That we need men who will study the Greek, and we not make fun of them nor of the Greek, because the New Testament was given to us by God, not in English, but in a Greek text. And we need to study Greek. We need to know Greek. And in our study, we need to use Greek. But when we preach, we need to be able to dip the cream of our studies off so that we can relate to the audience the biblical teachings in a way that their faith is edified and built up and strengthened, and remove any doubt that might occur that we do not have God's word. This morning we're going to deal, and I'm going to try to make this where you can understand our problem. And I think we need to note where the problem comes from. I have long believed that we need to know as much background information as possible and not just assume things. And let me make and come back to the story of Brother Warren, Dr. Ballard, for just a moment. Do not assume, because Dr. Ballard is a Baptist, that all Baptists deny the genuineness of Mark 16, 9 through 20. That is not the case. Because one of the strongest arguments given in this section of study was done by a Baptist by the name of John A. Brutus, who wrote a tremendous article in the Baptist Quarterly in the 1800s. Dealing with the style and the form and the vocabulary of Mark, replying to the textual critics that this is crucial against the genuineness of the passage. Dr. Brutus happened to be the son-in-law of A.T. Robertson, the great Greek grammarian in Lexington, Kentucky several years ago. So let's outline the problem and see why we have a problem in so many translations in the English that challenge Mark 16, 9 through 20 as being spurious. I want to suggest to you that the whole of Christendom for centuries accepted Mark 16, 9 through 20 as being from the pen of Mark, the son in the faith of Peter, and being genuine, as found in various manuscripts and as found in the Textus Receptus that underlies the King James Version. There are two definite periods involved. The first period stems from the first century to about the 18th century. Christendom accepted the genuineness of Mark 16, 9 through 20 as genuine. And from the middle of the ministry of Origen, though, in this time period, until the end of Jerome's scholarly work on the Latin Vulgate version. A small group of Christians doubted the authenticity of Mark 16, 9 through 20, but had no impact on religious scholars. The second period, in the middle of the 18th century, the genuineness of Mark 16, 9 through 20 began to be challenged and questioned. And done so, I would say earnestly and with great dedication, particularly by textual critics. The first, and we can trace it back to a J.S. Semler, who was professor at Halle University. He is known as the father of religious radicalism, which challenged the inerrancy of the Bible, which challenged the infallibility of the Bible and the trustworthiness of the Bible and the inspiration of the Bible. And consequently, beginning with him and with men that followed him, each took their own penknife. And through what we call textual criticism, which is a valid science, began to dissect and interpret the Bible as they saw fit. Semler sowed among his students at Halle University seeds of rejection and scorn towards historic Christianity by removing through his textual criticism as much of the supernatural from the Bible as he possibly could. Now, I've always been told, raised on a farm and gotten ready for our Saturday night visit to the town years ago, don't walk through the cow barn after you've taken a shower, because you smell. And you can't sit at the feet of men who deride the inspiration of the Scriptures, who deride the historic faith of Christianity, who challenge the trustworthiness of the Bible, and sit at their feet, and rarely can you come out not smelling like they smell. And as a consequence, he had a student by the name of J.J. Griesbach. Griesbach was among his students, and in 1775, he became professor of New Testament at Jena University in Germany. Griesbach had a passion for textual criticism. Now, textual criticism involves the ascertaining of the Greek text of the New Testament as it was originally given to us by the writers. In that, we do not have the original autographs. We have only copies of those autographs. Griesbach published his edition of the Greek text in 1806. This text lays the foundation work for the famous Westcott Hort, 1881, textual theories, as well as the most recent criticism and textual criticism and modern translations. At this time, when Griesbach was on the scene, rationalism was saturating Europe, and particularly his homeland of Germany. And consequently, Griesbach, following his teacher, was opposed to historic Christianity. He rejected the Textus Receptus and reconstructed what he considered was the Greek text behind our New Testament. He formulated various canons and various rules of textual criticism. And here's one of them. And here is one of the main rules. Any textual variant which weakened or undermined historic Christianity was the true reading of the text. He considered Mark 16, 9 through 20 as spurious or fraudulent, ending the book with verse 8 in the phrase, they were afraid. And after 1,400 years of almost overwhelmingly textual confidence in Mark 16, 9 through 20, a battle was opened that has lasted for 200 years in almost every New Testament translation and is a battle in this age. Griesbach was replaced at the university by a man by the name of Carl Lockman. He despised the Textus Receptus. He was not satisfied with the Greek text of Griesbach. So he produced his own Greek text of 1831. And he rejected Mark 16, 9 through 20 as spurious. Now, during this period of time, during Lockman's lifetime, the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus codices were discovered and circulated through the theological universities of Europe. The manuscripts are argued by some, though not convincingly, to have resulted from Emperor Constantine's order to Eusebius to prepare and present to society 50 Greek New Testaments. Both the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus manuscripts lack Mark 16, 9 through 20. The Vaticanus manuscript was found in the Vatican Library. And while the copy of the Vaticanus manuscript omits Mark 16, 9 through 20, there is a space at the end of chapter 15 and before Luke 1, that Mark 16, 9 through 20 can fit in, but it is left blank. But in the Sinaiticus manuscript, it is omitted, but the 16th chapter and part of the 15th chapter of Mark are written in larger letters, wider spaces between the lines, so as to fill that blank space, and then, when not completely filled with some decorations at the end. Interestingly, the Roman Catholic Church, which had the Vaticanus manuscript, accepts Mark 16, 9 through 20 as genuine. And I have two copies of the Vaticanus manuscript. One without, and the other Cardinal Mai's philological and exegetical commentary on the Vaticanus manuscript, in which he states that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is genuine from both manuscript and both textual criticism. That is interesting. That a prominent religious organization having a manuscript lacking this text of such great controversy, accepting it as indeed it is, genuine, and from the pen of Mark. Griesbach's influence is far-reaching. He influenced Constantine Tischendorf, who found the Sinaiticus manuscript as he was on St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai, getting ready to warm himself by picking up some material that he could throw into a fire to begin a fire. And when he picked it up, realized that it was an ancient manuscript, and it was the Sinaiticus manuscript. And he influenced Tischendorf's ultra jealous, B. Vice, A. Norton, Henry Alford, H. A. W. Meyer, B. F. Westcott, and F. J. A. Hort, and a host of other textual critics to conclude the Greek text of Mark 16, 9 through 20 is spurious, should not be in our Bibles. In fact, the Westcott-Hort text underlies the Revised Version from England of 1881 that later became the American Standard Version of 1901 here in America. Hort, at the age of 53, trained in classical Greek and no knowledge of Koine Greek, the Greek in which the New Testament was written, detested with a passion the Textus Receptus and the King James Version, and was determined. And scholars have pointed this out. He was determined with enthusiasm to destroy both. And he wrote a letter to a friend, which is found in his Life and Letters. He said, I had no idea. Now, he had been working on a Greek text. He said, I had no idea till the last few weeks of the importance of the text, having read so little Greek Testament and dragged on with the villainous Textus Receptus, the text behind our King James Version. And then he said, think of that vile Textus Receptus leaning entirely on late manuscripts. Many scholars, like Pickering and Cole and Weichenhauser and Clark and Sturtz and Eliot, have criticized the Westcott-Hort theory and their approach, and have called it a determined cleverness on the part of Westcott and Hort to use a major manuscript, the Vaticanus Codex. Now let me make this point. The United Bible Society's fourth revised edition of the Greek text and the Nestle-Aland's Greek text, the 27th edition, the text is identical, but the critical apparatus at the bottom of the page between the two texts are different. And if you're working with those, you need to use that or understand that. The UBS has fewer textual variants than the Nestle-Aland text. Both texts use what is called reason eclecticism to determine the best readings where a variant exists. They use both internal and external evidence, which you have to do. But they consider the most important criteria for preferred reading is that which best explains the existence of variant readings. Now you might say, what do you mean? Well, I said it's complex. They favor the Alexandrian text type, which is the Vaticanus text, and the basis of your New American Standard Bible and the New International Version, as well as a number of other translations. Consequently, the Westcott-Hort theory of textual criticism accommodated what I would call personal and predisposed prejudices against the King James Version and the Textus Receptus. And the result has been this. Almost every version, every translation since 1881 either has bracketed Mark 16, 9 through 20, double bracketed it, separated it, or simply omitted Mark 16, 9 through 20 altogether, thus questioning its genuineness, its trustworthiness, that it's divine revelation, that it is inspired, and that it was authored by Mark. Now, some textual critics claim that in addition to their omission of Codex Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus, it is sometimes stated, and some translations have this phrase, other authorities omit from verse 9 to the end. Other authorities not being listed, but here they are. Codices 23, 34, 39, 41. They're omitted on this basis that Servius of Antioch supposedly had said more accurate copies end at verse 8. Some textual critics started that. Other textual critics followed it without ever checking. But listen, here is the truth of the matter. 23, 34, and Codice 39 has no such note. And number 41 has the note that the more accurate copies contain Mark 16, 9 through 20. That is sloppy textual criticism. That is sloppy scholarship. And we need to be careful in our scholarship. Not only in textual criticism, but in all of our study and the presentation of biblical truths, that we make sure that we know all the facts and the circumstances related to things. Our study is limited by title to Mark 16, 9 through 20. It may be interesting to you to know that there are six different endings of the Gospel of Mark in Greek manuscripts. And I refer you to page 205 in the text for studies dealing with that ending. I didn't deal with them, but I give you the sources that you can read that do so. I would like to make this observation, that the long-standing question of the genuineness of Mark 16, 9 through 20 in various translations has caused the very latest work in Greek manuscripts to simply state the following. They come to Mark 16, verse 8. 9 through 20 is omitted, and they have this phrase, omit B and Aleph. B is the Vaticanus manuscript, Aleph is the Sinaiticus manuscript, and they make no further comment. They consider the evidence for Mark 16, 9 through 20 is not there. You can see that and read that in Reuben Swanson's work, New Testament Greek Manuscripts, variant readings arranged in a horizontal lines against the Codex Vaticanus, published 1995 by the Sheffield Press, an academic press from Sheffield, England. It's found in volume 2 of a 4-volume set. But how you resolve the problem? Since we don't have the original manuscripts and only copies, I'll assure that evidence is abundant in the copies that Matthew 16, 9 through 20 is genuine. And the scholars and translations who and which question the genuineness are in error. The Greek manuscripts is one of the testimonies that we have They number about 5,656 Greek manuscripts, 10,000 Latin manuscripts, and 1,000 other manuscripts in various languages. You have a majority text type known as a Byzantine text type, which underlies what is called the majority text and is related to, but not the same as, the Textus Receptus. But they contain 85% to 90% of all the Greek manuscripts. And those which we possess date from the 4th century, but their mere existence in the 4th century argues for an earlier base. You have a Western text type that dates from AD 200 and reflects the text of the early Christians in the country of Palestine and Asia Minor. These are similar to the old Latin of Jerome's Latin Vulgate. And then you have the Alexandrian text type, called sometimes the neutral text. And it is found in the earliest manuscripts, which are the Vaticanus manuscript and the Sinaiticus manuscript and some papyri writing. But because a manuscript is early, does not necessarily mean that it is the most accurate. Now, let me make this point. The Sinaiticus manuscript omits many of your New Testament books. If it is so valuable, why don't we not take those books out? Besides Mark 16, 9 through 20. And the Vaticanus manuscript, while it is a complete text except for Mark 16, 9 through 20, includes the Epistle of Barnabas. And why do we not add it if it is such an authority? Because it is so early to a New Testament. I just raise those questions for you to think. You're prejudicing our mind, Brother Barner. I want to suggest to you that Westcott Hort was very prejudiced to the Textus Receptus and the King James Version. Secondly, under the Greek manuscripts, they're divided into two text types. We have what is called unsealed manuscripts, in which they were all written in capital letters. They all date prior to the 9th century. There are 276 of these, 85% to 90% belonging to the Byzantine text type. The two oldest unseals, the Vaticanus Sinaiticus, are not Byzantine text type. And they admit, as we said, under different conditions, Mark 16, 9 through 20. The cursive manuscripts are those written in flowing script or cursive writing. There are 2,795 of these with their fragments. And 85% to 90% of them are the Byzantine text type. Interestingly, Westcott Hort and the textual critics that follow reject the Byzantine text type as an inferior text. There are abundant Greek codices and texts which have Mark 16, 9 through 20 as genuine. And I refer you to pages 205 and 206 in the book. Number two, the testimony of the ancient versions. The New Testament canon closed when the book of Revelation, written in AD 96, was completed. The New Testament was written in Greek. Not everybody was fluent in Greek. As a consequence, the Greek scriptures needed to be translated. And they were translated in the Syriac or Aramaic language, probably first, because that was in the area of Palestine in that section of the country. But also in Latin and in Gothic and in Armenian and in Egyptian and various other languages. The versions of the Greek New Testament predate, or the versions of the Greek New Testament or manuscripts which they have will predate those that we possess. And we have listed on pages 206 to 208 many of these. Tatian's Diatessaron, which is a harmony of the Gospels written in AD 170, contains Mark 16, 9 through 20 as genuine. The old Syriac version has a Gospel of Mark, but the only thing in the Syriac version in the Gospel of Mark that it possesses is Mark 16, 17 through 20. Which suggests that they accepted it as genuine. Then the testimony of the early Christian writers. There are few Greek New Testament manuscripts from AD 300 to AD 600. But you have nearly over 200 Christian writers. And this patristic evidence, we have their writings there extant, not inspired, but quote the New Testament, and sometimes accurately, sometimes loosely, they allude to the New Testament, they refer to various biblical passages and manuscripts then in existence, but which have not survived because, being papyrus, written on papyrus, the elements of nature, except in the land of Egypt, do not permit their survival. But these early writings show evidence that these writers were familiar with Mark 16, 9 through 20, and various other biblical texts, and they used Greek manuscripts that were earlier than any that we have. There's a list of 12 of these in the lectureship book. But listen, Papias of Hierapolis knew Mark 16, 9 through 20, and he wrote within a decade of the close of the first century. You know what's interesting about these writers? They do not belong to any one particular age, with the exception that they predate the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus codices. They do not belong to any particular school of religious thought. They do not pertain to any one country. They come from every part of the world of Christendom in the ancient church. And they bear direct evidence that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is genuine. Read 208 through 210. Now the testimony from the lectionaries. You say lectionaries? We don't use that word. But in the Syriac or Aramaic-speaking churches, they began to devise a schedule out of the Bible of reading each service. And these are very valuable because they tell us what they read. They tell us what texts are genuine, at least give substantial evidence for. And while they did not bear the testimony of a single man, a single manuscript, or family of manuscripts, though most of the lectionaries belong to the Byzantine family of manuscripts, they present evidence that the New Testament text, Mark 16, 9 through 20, was from the Greek manuscripts which they had and used in their possession. Now, one of the arguments against the genuineness of Mark 16, 9 through 20 is Mark's style and vocabulary, that it is different in those verses from 9 through 20 than in the rest of the Gospel of Mark. They're not dealing with English words, they're dealing with a Greek text. And most of the critics who reject Mark 16, 9 through 20 appeal to this difference in style and vocabulary by arguing from internal evidence against the genuineness of the text and the genuineness of the authorship of Mark. It is the case that it is no argument in their favor. But when seriously studied and deliberately studied, it becomes a strong argument for the genuineness of the text and the Markian authorship of the gospel. Now, among the critics are men like H.A.W. Meyer and Henry Alford in his commentary on the Greek New Testament and his commentary on the New Testament for English readers. Alford's statement is interesting, and it's amusing. He writes that these verses seem to be conical, though they cannot be regarded as part of the original narrative of St. Mark. Just think on that. And you can see why it's interesting and why really it is amusing. This attitude challenges the inspiration, the revelation, the preservation, the trustworthiness, the genuineness of the Bible and Bible texts. And I suggest that you obtain a copy of Brodus's Baptist Quarterly article of 1869, volume 3, and read pages 354 to 362. He answered it, and he has never been dealt with. I conclude that sufficient evidence exists and can be gathered and is available from a testimony of the Greek manuscripts, the ancient versions, the early Christian writers, the church lectionaries, which are just a schedule of scripture that was read, and a testimony of the style and the vocabulary of Mark 16, 9 through 20, and other textual critical studies that we can affirm and that we can believe without a shadow of doubt that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is genuine, written by Mark, the son in the faith of Peter, in his gospel that we love so dearly, the Gospel of Mark. I thank you.